Kindler is handy. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the University Professors Program. Speaking is Professor Willard Spiegelman of the Department of English at Southern Methodist University. Professor Spiegelman's lecture is titled A Poet's Life in Letters, The Case of Amy Clampett. Professor Spiegelman.
This talk is going to be somewhat in the way of an old-fashioned life and letters. And there will be three voices involved. The first is that of me, Willard Spiegelman, a fan of and someone who knew Amy Clampett a little bit, not as well as some of the people in this room. I knew her a little bit while she was alive. I came to know her a lot better after she died. And also Willard Spiegelman, a critic of poetry. The second voice, this is in the ascending order of importance, is that of Amy Clampett, the woman whose autobiography I helped her posthumously to assemble in the collection of letters, because, of course, a book of letters is an autobiography. With certain things, sometimes by intention, sometimes by accident, omitted. And I would say that even if Amy Clampett were not an important poet, as I feel she is, the letters themselves would be an interesting literary document because they make, I think, for compelling reading, especially because Amy Clampett was an unknown for the first 60 of her 74 years. So she will, when the next pope gets around to his business, she will be designated the patron saint of late bloomers. And so she lived entirely in obscurity for most of her life. And this fact makes her letters different from those of other people whose letters have come out recently. I'll say more about that later. And the third voice in which I will speak will be that of Amy Clampett, the poet, without which probably neither of the other two voices would be that interesting, and certainly without which that second voice, Amy Clampett as a writer of letters, would not have been possible because the letters would not have been published at all. Amy Clampett looked like a tea cozy, and she lived like a bohemian, and she thought like a radical, and she sounded, especially when reading her poems, like an exciting, precocious teenager. If Marilyn Monroe had been an intellectual, this is what she would have sounded like. She would have sounded like Amy Clampett. And she wrote like an angel. Let me start with one of the poems on your handouts. There are three poems on this sheet, and I want to start with the one that's the second in the list, called Losing Track of Language, which is from Clampett's second book called What the Light Was Like, published in 1985. And I give this to you as an example of her poetry, an example of something which I rather like in her poetry and something which is typical, and I'll say something about it after I read it. The train leaps toward Italy. The French Riviera falls away in the dark. The rails sing dimeter, shifting to trimeter, a galopade to a galliard. We sit wedged among strangers. Whatever we once knew, it was never much, of each other falls away with the landscape. Words fall away. We trade instead in flirting and cigarettes. We're all rapport with strangers. The one with the yellow forelock that keeps falling and being shaken back again, syncopating the dimeter, trimeter, galopade into galliard, is, it seems, Italian, recently a pilgrim to the Vaucluse, where Petrarca, to the noise of waterfalls, measured out his strict stanzas, little rooms for turmoil to grow lucid in, for change to put on more durable leaves of bronze, a scapular of marble. A splutter of pleasure at hearing the name is all he needs, and he's off like a racehorse at the Palio, plunging unbridled into recited cadenzas, three-beat lines interleaving a liquid pentameter. What are words? They fall away into the fleeing dark of the French Riviera as once a shower of bloom. Una pioggia di fior descended into the lap of the Trecento, her hair all golden pearl, the grass still warm as when she sat there, 6 centuries gone by, that squandered heartbeat, the black plague took her, young, now fossilized as bronze, as carved laurel. Whatever is left of her is language. And what is language but breath, leaves, petals fallen, or in the act of falling, pollen of turmoil that sifts through the fingers? E conosce? I ask it to keep the torrent of words from ending, to keep anything from ending ever. Anche Sappho? Yes, he knows, he will oblige. The limpid pentameter gives way to something harsher. Diphthongs condense, take on an edge of bronze. Though I don't understand a word, what are words? Do these concern one Timus, led before she was married, or so one leaf of what's left would have it, to the dark bedroom of Persephone, for so long nowhere at home, either here or there, forever returning and falling back again into the dark of these 10,000 years. The train leaps toward Italy. Words fall away through the dark into the dark bedroom of everything left behind, the unendingness of things lost track of who, of where I'm losing track of language. Well, what can we infer about both the nature of the poem and the person who wrote it? Well, about this poem, we can infer many things. First of all, the poet loves long sentences. And this, you ain't seen the half of it. Amy Clampett wrote more poems of one sentence, and I mean things longer than a sonnet, than any other contemporary American poet. Poems that are 40, 50 lines long and one sentence long. Of course, they're broken up into parts, so theoretically they could be other sentences. And she had the voice measure to deliver these long sentences very much in the same way that Allen Ginsberg, whom I would not mention in the same breath with her, could deliver the long lines of his poems. And this is very much in the Whitmanian tradition in American poetry, a tradition into which she fits for other reasons as well. Second of all, we can imagine that this is a woman who loves energy in articulation and rhythm, the dimeter, trimeter, the tracks of the trains going clunkety, 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 clunk, being imitated in the verses of the poem. Third of all, a commitment to high literary culture that traverses linguistic and historical boundaries. Next, an interest in travel itself. She loved travel. She loved travel by train. When she could in her lifetime, she made all of her trips to Europe by boat. She hated flying. And at the end of her life, when she was awarded lots of honors and given lots of invitations, she traveled everywhere. She accepted all of the invitations to read and to speak. And she traveled whenever possible by bus. She loved buses. And she made friends with people on the bus about which I will say more later. Next of all, a commitment to the way, and this is Eliot's phrase, of course, that poems can communicate before they are understood. Eliot, of course, was thinking of Dante when he said that, and she's thinking in this poem about the languages, Italian and Greek, of Petrarch and Sappho, even though she can't really understand the Greek that the stranger is reciting to her. And last of all, a kind of intellectual and poetic playfulness with leitmotifs. This is a kind of serious poem in which the seriousness and the theme are dexterously handled, primarily on a linguistic level. And the leitmotifs are, of course, those of leaves, leavings, things left behind, and loss, which is, in fact, one of her, I think, great themes, the nature of loss itself. The poem, of course, is an accumulation of details, but like Elizabeth Bishop's great Villanelle One Art, it's also a detailing of losing things, things built up and things lost at the same time. Clampett was a cultural presence on the scene from 1978 until 1994. Her first poems appeared in periodicals in 1978. Her first book appeared when she was 63. In 1983, her fame, her notoriety rose like a comet. She was lauded by many. She was derided by some as well. James Dickey was sitting next to her at a dinner party once, and he looked at her and said, "You write about flowers," in a highly derogatory tone. And another person said to her in a letter that I'll quote from in a little while, "You're in love with words," by which he meant, she says, "I use too many of them." You're in love with words, as though a poet should be in love with anything other than words. There were many feminist critics who took umbrage and who objected to her commitment to high culture, to ornate diction, to Baroque syntax, to the fact that she uses sometimes highly technical vocabulary that sends you to a dictionary, as though this were something that a poet should not do or a reader of poetry should not welcome having been asked to do, and that she was Eurocentric, and that she wrote poems that seemed to be more ornamental and more artificial than the plain speaking poems which they would have preferred. One critic called her work, and I'm quoting, "a parody of the Victorian silk that Pound sought to unravel." Another, referring to the energy, which I take as a wonderful fact about her poem, referred to it as bathetic enthusiasm that emerges from the forced accumulations of her details. One friend of mine, who rather liked some of the poems, said that reading them or sitting down with the collected poems was like sitting down to a whole meal of desserts. Overrich, too much. My involvement with her as a poet and a woman, and then as an editor, goes back to my reading the first poems as they appeared in The New Yorker and The Atlantic in the late 70s, and then when The Kingfisher came out in 1983. I hosted her in Dallas in 1983 or 84. I saw her a couple of times when I was in New York in 1985 and 86. I wrote, and then several other times thereafter, I wrote several essays and reviews of her, the last of which was a review of her posthumously published collected poems. And then, when her husband died in 2001, I was asked by her literary executors if I would be willing to undertake an edition of her letters. I had never done anything like this before. I had no experience as an editor of anything. I said, what would be involved? They said, well, we'll give you her house in the Berkshires and Lenox to live in on a monthly stipend. I said, oh, okay, I'll do it. So fools rush in. I was asked, because I'm speaking here at the Editorial Institute, to say something about my editorial principles. And I can do that very easily. I had no editorial principles. I proceeded very much in an ad hoc way, not knowing what there was going to be involved and not knowing exactly how my task was going to unfold. I think anybody who is involved in a search for letters knows what it's like to start trying to accumulate them. And in the case of Clampett, this was made harder by the fact that, and I'll say more about this in a moment, she was not famous. And my accumulation of her letters took several forms. I had her address books, which were given to me by her executors. She had a terrible spidery hand, and most of the address books were in pencil. I hired graduate students to type out all of the names and addresses, and I wrote everybody a letter saying, if you have letters from Amy Clampett, I would like to see them. I placed ads in the normal venues, the New York Review of Books and the New York Times, and I heard from various people. Now, one of the problems was that many of the letters came back to me, addressee unknown, moved. Many of the people were simply absent or gone. And even more of them were permanently or seriously gone because they were in heaven. So for somebody who left no paper trail, it's very hard to accumulate a bunch of letters. But I was able to do that. Several of the reviews of the letters when the book came out, including the one in the Boston Globe, took me to task for not including more annotation. And the model against which I was held was the Saskia Hamilton publication of the Robert Lowell letters. So to the extent that I can offer as principles a kind of justification or self-defense, I would say the following things to those critics who want more footnotes. One, I think a reader is being done a service by not having footnotes rather than a disservice. Two, I was given by an academic, not a commercial press, a page limit, a word limit. They said, we want X number of words in this book. So one of the questions one has to ask oneself as an editor is, if given this kind of choice, do you want more of Amy or more of you? And since her own letters were so good, I naturally, not out of majestic indolence, I naturally opted for the former on the theory that anything that was there that was problematic could be looked up. And so my model was not the Hamilton Lowell letters, which of course I had not seen, but Robert Giroux's Bishop letters, which involves very little annotation, as does Langdon Hammer's edition of the correspondence of Hard Crane and Alan Tate. One can have a book of letters with minimal annotation. Next of all, there is no need, I think, to tell readers of a volume of letters who Dante and Henry James are, which is often done, I think, in some of these things. And last of all, and this goes back to the fact that Amy had been unknown for so many years, there are references in the letters to various friends and relatives, and it simply was impossible to find out who they were. I would inquire of Amy's remaining siblings, and her nephews and nieces, and her old friends, people who were in their 80s by the time I reached them, do you remember this one or that one, or who was this one or that one? And the answer, well, no, we can't remember that. We can't remember who he was. Secondly, she was very private and secretive herself. So, for example, there's the whole issue of lovers, boyfriends, things of that sort, which on the one hand she did not discuss very much in her letters, and also, really on the same hand, the various friends of hers from New York in the 40s said, well, yes, there was a man she was engaged to, but we don't remember his name. And then there was an Englishman with whom she was having an affair, but she was very private about that. And then there was this other man. And then I saw pictures in old family albums of Amy as a young working girl in New York at the beach with two men. Who were they? And they're all wearing very, very sort of flimsy bathing costumes. They all look very intimate with one another. There's no way to know. I mean, there was no paper trail. Because she wasn't famous until she got to be over 60, unlike Robert Lowell, unlike Elizabeth Bishop, unlike James Merrill, all of whom published their first volumes young, all of whom were parts of a literary community, she didn't have any correspondence with literary people. She was not part of any circle, and the letters, at least for the first 60 years, are really to friends and to relatives, most of which, of course, now, many of which are lost entirely. So she didn't leave a paper trail. Let me give you a mini biography. She was born in 1920 in New Providence, Iowa. Her parents were Quaker farmers. She was the eldest of five children, she was of whom two brothers survive. She was bookish, eccentric, slightly weird from the beginning. Two things right away that she got from her upbringing from Quaker parents on a farm were a strong Quaker commitment to political justice, which engaged her for the rest of her life, and second of all, an eye for landscape, which if you grow up in Iowa, I presume, requires a different kind of eye from the eye you would have if you were being raised, say, in a lush New England village or in Old England. The landscape was flat, and she loved it. And she loved Iowa. She made certain that she would get the hell out of there as fast as possible when she was graduated from Grinnell College in 1941, but she kept returning to it. And the last poem that I will talk to you about is one that involves her memories of Iowa. She had an eye for detail, and this eye and these details, I think, are apparent in both the poems and the letters. She had a naturalist eye for detail. Hopkins was a favorite writer, Darwin was a favorite writer, and Ruskin, too. The three great observers in the 19th century were all role models for her. She loved writing about weather, she loved writing about plants, she loved writing about landscape, and she loved writing about travel. The third thing, and this is something that I mentioned briefly before in talking about losing track of language, that she got from her early upbringing was a sense of loss. When she was 10, the farm on which she grew up was sold, and the family had to move. Now, when I first heard this story, I thought, oh, it was 1930, it was the Depression, they lost the mortgage, they lost the farm, Eden was lost. In fact, that was not the case. They simply sold one farm and moved 5 miles away to another farm. I would think one farm would be the same as another, but this was a trauma for her, and that sense of loss that informs all of her poetry stems back to this major fact in 1930 when they had to move, and so the beloved landscape was left behind in favor of something else. Describing landscape is something that in her poems is both an end in itself and often, as description often is, became a surrogate for other things. When I said before that she had an intensely private life, I was reminded in speaking to one of her oldest friends of the fact, as this friend articulated it so well, that in Amy's poetry, descriptions of landscape often stand in for human relations. So there's a kind of surrogate or a kind of symbolic use of one kind of thing for another in the poems. She went to Manhattan in 1941. She had a fellowship for graduate work at Columbia. She dropped, like so many writers, she dropped out of graduate school, realizing that it wasn't for her, that she wanted to be a writer. And she dropped out before the year was up. And then she supported herself in a series of jobs, the most important one of which was a job at Oxford University Press, which she took circa 1943. She started as a receptionist, became a secretary, became an intern, became an assistant editor, worked her way up an academic ladder, an editorial ladder, until she became something like the head of permissions for foreign rights. Which brings us to 1949, when a major event occurred. Oxford University Press had an essay contest, sponsored a contest, and the contest was an essay on the subject of why I want to go to England. And the prize, the winning prize, was a trip to England. Amy entered. Amy won. One of the things that young people have to realize is that in 1940, say, 8 and 9, it was the first time that Americans could go to Europe as tourists. The continent had been closed, essentially, for 15 years. And this is the generation of James Merrill and Richard Wilbur and Anthony Hecht, some of whom had been in Europe as soldiers, but they could go back now and examine the culture of Europe. Amy went to London. She had a wonderful time. She met a woman who became a good friend and a correspondent for the next 45 years. And when she came back, she quit her job at OUP in order to write, which is what she had gone to Manhattan to do in the first place. Now, one of the interesting facts about Clampett, I don't want to say she's unique, but she's certainly unusual, is that for a person who is, I think, a very good poet, it took her a long time to find not her métier as a writer, but her genre. She thought of herself as a novelist. And in the 50s, when she quit her job and was supporting herself on her savings, she wrote three unpublished, and I can say they're unpublished because they are unpublishable, having looked at part of them in her spidery hand, novels, which are in her papers in Lenox, Massachusetts, and everything will ultimately go to the Berg Collection, where her papers now are. So for those of you looking for editorial projects, this would be something to consider. The novels are awful. They are long on description, long on philosophy, long on debate on theological issues. If George Bernard Shaw wanted to write a novel, it might end up something like this. And they're very short on plot and character, the things that we would like to see in a novel. One of the omissions, I must say, that was very interesting to me in assembling her letters is that we have no letters from her from before 1950. The first letter in this book is 1950. She'd been living in New York for 9 years. She was a young woman in her 20s. She was a career girl in Manhattan. There was a war going on. Sailors and soldiers were shipping out. 1945, they were coming back. What was she doing? We don't know. We simply don't know. So unless something comes, you know, some other letters become available, we don't. She lived on the same street or around the corner from where Leonard Bernstein was living, where Anatole Breuer lived. He wrote a wonderful book called Kafka Was All the Rage about what it was like to be in the village in 1946. Madeleine L'Engle lived on her block. We don't know. Gone. In the 50s, she began a long series of letters, which constitute about a third of this book, to her youngest brother, Philip. One of the things that made my editorial job easy and wonderful was that when you deal with somebody, first of all, who is typing rather than using a pen, you have a great advantage in transcribing or having transcribed for you a piece of writing. Second of all, and it's hard to imagine this now, especially among young people, the letters she wrote were letter perfect. There were no rough drafts. She wrote her letters. They were crystalline, lucid, needless to say, perfectly spelled, perfectly punctuated. You know, the modest, occasional, minor typographical error intrudes. But by and large, the letters were finished, polished works of art. Some of them were 15, 20 pages long, single-spaced, typed letters. And these constitute a chapter in a woman's experiential life, but even more in her inner and intellectual life. Let me read you one excerpt from a letter she wrote to her youngest brother, Philip. This is 1955, Nel Mezzo del Cammin. I mean, she's 35 years old here. And it says something about not only her style, but also about her character, her temperament, which comes across in the prose and also in the poetry. Philip has just said to her, "I don't think I want to be a teacher." And she writes back and says, "As for your not wanting to go into the teaching profession, I can understand it very well, since I think I feel pretty much the same way about it. One doesn't want to be pushing other people around with so much pushing around going on already all over the place. It was the same thing that made me decide I couldn't go back into the publishing business or any other business. I didn't want to go on telling people to buy books I wouldn't have bought myself. The only redeeming feature about the job I did at the Oxford Press, aside from the people I met and the fact that it sent me to England, both of which had incalculable effects on the entire course of my life, was that there was a certain latitude for creativeness. I set my own standards for the kind of thing I turned out, but I finally had to admit to myself that however much the result might be admired, there was no proof that those standards had any effect on what I was supposed to be doing, namely, to sell more books. All the good taste and originality were just trimming, and they were costing money, which, whether the people who paid my salary cared or not, I felt guilty about. So either it was a matter of turning completely cynical or simply pulling up stakes and starting over. Of course, I didn't have all this thought out when I left to go to Europe, or even after I came back, but I see now that this is what it amounted to. And it isn't that I don't believe in the publishing business, since anybody who cares about literature as I do has to believe in it, nor do I doubt that there are people in it who care sincerely and who have the satisfaction of accomplishing something in cooperation with other people, which is, after all, the only real satisfaction. But I had, as I still have, a horror of turning professional, of having a label stuck on me, which sooner or later might have eaten in and become more than skin deep. It's one of my own peculiar difficulties that while on the one hand I don't want to push other people around, on the other, and even more intensely, I don't want to do what I'm told unless I myself see a reason for it. And it isn't just that I can't conform. There was a time, in fact, when I conformed all too easily, with the result that I was usually conforming to several totally different patterns at once. Most incapacitating. It's of the Abraham Lincoln variety, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. And I was struck just the other day reading a remark by, of all people, Harold Bloom, concerning, of all people, Fanny Price in Mansfield Park. And it struck me so much I wrote it down, because here's what Bloom says about Fanny Price. She never seeks power over the will of any other person. And he goes on to say, the lesson of the Protestant will in Austen, George Eliot, and Richardson is that, and I'm quoting Harold here, that the refusal to seek power over other wills is what opens the inward eye of vision. Fanny Price's vision is necessarily moral, but could as truly be called spiritual, even aesthetic. The sentence applies perfectly to Amy Clampett, and it's another legacy, I think, not only of radical Protestantism, but also of her own Quaker upbringing. In the 50s, she had a remarkable experience. She was always in quest for certain kinds of truth: political truth, vocational truth, artistic truth, and spiritual truth. And in 1956, she had the only word to describe it is an epiphany that occurred to her while at the Cloisters one Sunday afternoon in Upper Manhattan. I'm going to read you another excerpt from the letters. She talks about looking at the tapestries, which for some reason she said today I preferred to painting. So she was looking at the tapestries there. And she said, I don't know that I was intellectually conscious of anything except thorough enjoyment. The place was full of people, most of whom had cameras, and who appeared to have come primarily for the purpose of taking snapshots of each other. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. And even before camcorders, there they were, recording the experience. Even so, I didn't mind them in the least. When it came time for the regular Sunday program of transcribed medieval music, I found myself a stone instead of a chair to sit on and watch them file in. And after a while, when the first Kyrie started, I stopped watching the people and simply concentrated on listening to the music and watching the sunlight come in at a 13th century window. The Kyrie, which of course is a cry for mercy, and the sun on the stone, a purely physical phenomenon, seemed, while I listened, to have some affinity, almost to be one and the same thing. After a while, when the music changed to something else, I was mildly aware that while this was going on, I had, perhaps for no more than an instant, but there's no measuring this kind of experience, had entirely forgotten my own existence. It's the sort of thing that has happened to me a few times in my life, but always before in moments of great excitement, and with a kind of incredulity surrounding it like an iron ring. This time, there was no iron ring, no excitement, no surprise even, but a serenity so complete that I hardly thought about it just then. I simply took it for granted. Possibly this is what is supposed to take place at baptism. But if baptism it wasn't of water, but of light. By this time, it was late afternoon, and with the reflection from the river so bright you could barely look at it directly, the whole hilltop, the whole world, was fairly brimming with radiance. I walked around for a while, looked at the people, and walked to the subway rather tired, and yet rested and pleased with everything. Later, in the very same long letter, she's talking about reading and thinking about Keats's letters and Catherine Mansfield's letters, both great letter writers, both died young, both died of tuberculosis, and thinking about Mansfield's letters, and Mansfield was reading Keats, knew she was going to die. And then Amy thinks about the fear of death. The fear of death is what, more than anything else, gives her letters their beauty. And I had found myself almost envying the intensity even of her fear, though the truth is that I have felt something like it at times, and it is not a thing one ought to envy. But it was as though that afternoon any possibility of envy like this had been obliterated. It was only by degrees that I began to be able to describe to myself the experience, which was not a temporary extinction of personality, but the opposite. For the first time in my life, without even knowing that I knew it, I had been without fear. This is the negative way of stating it. The positive statement has ramifications which are still unfolding, and for all I know, they will go on unfolding. She then says that she began to write about the experience later that day, the experience at the Cloisters. She had begun to keep a notebook, a journal, and she thought that she would enter this into her notebook as the beginning of a short story. I decided to try to make a short story out of it, purely for the exercise, and then something happened which I could absolutely never have predicted. I have not altogether recovered yet from the surprise, though I suppose I shall get used to it in time. Quite as though they had a will of their own, the sentences broke in a way that was not my usual style at all. Rather frightened, I must admit, for the moment, I let them break. The next thing I knew, they had begun to reach out for rhymes. This frightened me almost more, until I discovered that finding a rhyme could be almost as natural a process as the resolution of a dominant chord. I didn't have to look for them. They simply came. Now, I have not even so much as thought of wanting to write poetry since I was about 16 and produced the usual 16-year-old effusions. I associated writing in verse with adolescence. There was a time, even, when I stopped reading poetry, though that was terminated a good while back. So here I am, writing a long poem. It is already something like 500 lines, and though the end appears to be in sight, I am not sure. When it is finished, you shall see it if you want to. The poem was a long poem, in rhymed combination of couplets and quatrains. It's about religion. It's about conversion. It's about light and water. It is about grace. What happened to Amy that day was a double kind of epiphany. One, she had been looking for religion, and at this point in her life, she then underwent a conversion to high Episcopalianism. And for the next 10 years of her life, she went to a high church in the village. She went out to a convent in New Jersey to spend weekends. She was deeply involved in high Anglicanism. Two, she found her métier as a poet. I mean, this was a visitation of grace. P.S., that poem she wrote was awful. It was rhymed. It was awful. It was nothing like the poems that we have come to cherish her for. And it was really another 20 years before she found the voice of the poet that we have come to know through her publication. The incident that she describes of the cloisters is, as I said to my students in Romantic Poetry last month, a textbook defense or proof of Wordsworth's idea that poetry is first emotion recollected in tranquility, then the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings, as though the experience itself had to be relived afterwards, put into words, at which point her heart can dance with the daffodils. Speaking of Wordsworth reminds me of the fact that she had always been committed to, of course, the Romantic poets, to Keats, Wordsworth, Dorothy Wordsworth, Coleridge, the whole circle of them. And that this, as another example of the fact that she was awkward about her genre. Late in life, after she had established herself as a poet, she wanted to write a play, and she went on to write a play, and I read part of the play, and everybody read the play, and it was dreadful. And a stage reading of it was done at Harvard at the Agassiz Theater, and all of her friends from Cambridge were there, and it was dreadful. It was a play about the Wordsworths. Now, this is not a subject that would naturally, I think, conjure up great stage action, but if Henry James could fail as a playwright, why can't Amy Clampett? So this, you know, circa 1989, 1990. In this same letter that I just read from, she then segues into thinking about the Brontes, and she talks about the Brontes, their early deaths, etc. And she says, the Brontes are a kind of family apotheosis of the death wish. And she says, this just came. So, of course, they had to die early. She's talking about Emily. She had to die early. It was her wish. This just came to me. I feel as if I could write a whole history of English literature and know just where to place everybody in it with hardly any trouble at all. The reason being, apparently, that I feel, and this is in italics, I feel that I am in it. Keats says, I think I shall be among the English poets after my death. And here's Amy saying at the age of 35, with no literary achievement at all, I think I am in it. This will be true whether or not I am recognized now or remembered later. And though, however many rash statements I may make, I don't think I ordinarily make rash predictions, I feel this may happen too. I suppose you can preserve this as a piece of documentary evidence, whichever way it turns out. But I've been walking around in places familiar to Blake and Shelley, and I don't know who else. I have a vague idea that I may share a family resemblance with those two, though they are not my masters. My masters are Thoreau first and Dante last, and in between, Henry James. One of the things that appear in the letters is the testimony to a life granted to literature, especially literature as a reader. She was a consumer of literature, and what she writes mostly about in these letters, before she wrote anything herself, was what she had been reading. So we flash forward. She's writing in the 50s. In the 60s, she becomes involved in political activity, first the civil rights movement, then the anti-war movement, then the nascent women's movement, and circa 1966, in her anger or her impatience with the Episcopal Church to take a stronger anti-war stance, she leaves the church and resumes her sort of Quaker upbringing, going to protests. The letters are filled with wonderful descriptions of going to Washington, getting jailed, going on rent strikes, ending up in jail. She was a little old lady with pencils in her hair at this point, who was marching with the kids and taking in the smell of marijuana and getting arrested. In 1968, while campaigning for Eugene McCarthy, she met the man who became the partner of her life for the next 25 years, a law professor named Harold Korn. She moved in with him shortly after they got together. She always retained until the last year of her life the little Virginia Woolfian room of her own in Greenwich Village, 354 West 12th Street, a fifth-story walk-up in a building there, which she held on to because it was her own. But she kept her move in with Hal as a secret from many of her conventional relatives because she didn't want them to know, here she was, you know, in her late 40s, that she was shacking up with a man without benefit of clergy. It would have appalled some of them. In 1977, in the fall, she took a writing course at the New School. And she was one of many old-fashioned beatniks taking writing courses. And she had an instructor whom I finally tracked down. She never mentions him by name in the letters. A man who must have been younger than she then, a person of no particular distinction, whom I've spoken to on the phone, but he obviously lit something in her, and she began writing the poems that became the poems in The Kingfisher, her first book. And something she describes in letters is her excitement at going to open readings in Greenwich Village coffee houses, open mic nights, that kind of thing, being very shy, being trained by her lawyer boyfriend and by another friend of hers who was an actor to project, sing out Louise, they would say to her, and she found that she was a ham. She loved it. She loved performing. And exactly at that same point in the late 70s, she began submitting her poems to magazines. As a magazine editor, I am aware of the thousands of poems that come in every minute from people in creative writing programs. And the poems were accepted. And she had the double and very curious, if not unique, experience of coming home one day and finding a letter of acceptance from Howard Moss, the late poetry editor of The New Yorker, accepting a poem for The New Yorker. It was an interesting experience because she had not submitted the poem to The New Yorker. The man who was her boss at Dutton, the publishing house for which she was doing freelance editing, had taken it upon himself to submit some of her poems to Howard Moss. So Amy came home, and there was this acceptance from The New Yorker. She had already had other poems accepted elsewhere. The poem that first appeared in The New Yorker was the poem that's the first on your handout. Let me just read that to you, called The Sun Underfoot Among the Sundews, a poem which is really a kind of reworking of Robert Frost's design. This is a paper topic that my yet unknowing students at SMU will have to confront in another couple of weeks. It's called a compare and contrast paper. Here's Robert Frost, here's the sonnet, here's Amy. See what you can say about them. And the first thing, of course, that I think strikes everybody about this poem is the wonderful mellifluousness of the repeated vowel sounds as well as the consonantal sounds in the title. Sundew is an insectivorous bog plant, very common in Maine. I was told by a woman I know in Texas that they also appear in the piney bogs of East Texas, though not in as great profusion as they do in Maine. An ingenuity too astonishing to be quite fortuitous is this bog full of sundews, sphagnum-lined and shaped like a teacup. A step down and you're into it. A wilderness swallows you up. Ankle, then knee, then midriff to shoulder deep in wet-footed understory, an overhead spruce tamarack horizon hinting you'll never get out of here. But the sun among the sundews, down there, is so bright, an underfoot webwork of carnivorous rubies, a star swarm thick as the gnats they're set to catch, delectable double-faced cocklebirds, each hairtip a sticky mirror afire with sunlight, a million of them, and again a million, each mirror a trap set to unhand unbelieving that either a first cause said once, let there be sundews, and there were, or they've made their way here unaided other than by that backhand roundabout refusal to assume responsibility known as natural selection. But the sun underfoot is so dazzling, down there among the sundews, there is so much light in the cup that looking, you start to fall upward. It's a wonderful, vertiginous poem, and of course it is a poem about an important theme at the same time. At exactly this time, she was discovered, and she was discovered by several people simultaneously, most prominently, I guess, Helen Vendler at Harvard, who took her on as a supporter and helped Amy win Guggenheim Fellowships and then a MacArthur Genius Award in 1990. And the other person who became her champion was the very young poet Mary Jo Salter, who was at this point in the late 70s reading as Peter Davison's assistant at The Atlantic the slush pile of poems. And she came upon some poems that Amy had sent in, and she recognized first of all the quality of the poetry, and also then she recognized the name. And she wrote Amy a fan letter saying, I love your poems, and I assume that you are, like me, a young, unknown poet. And Amy wrote back and said, well, unknown, yes, young, no. But let me read you the letter that she wrote to Mary Jo at this point. Having said 25 years earlier that she could write a history of English literature because she thinks she's in it, here she is after 25 years, well, many more years of total obscurity. Dear Mary Jo Salter, your letter pleased me more than you can possibly imagine. Since you're a poet, I wouldn't be able to say such a thing if it weren't for our belonging to different generations. And to have evoked such friendliness from a younger poet amounts to nothing less than a milestone. Few things could please me more than to trade poems with someone sympathetic, and so I'm sending along perhaps more than you'll feel like coping with. I hope you won't feel swamped, and of course you're not obliged to read everything in the little book. If you do, this was a little book that had been privately printed. This is before the Kingfisher came out. If you do, you'll find lots of exercises, throes of self-expression, and all the weight of the grand tradition. Milton, yet. The book came about mainly because I got to know a young man who was trying against the tide to be a letterpress printer. He's since become a casualty of the economy and gone back to working for someone other than himself. At the time, though I sent out things occasionally and got them back, I wasn't quite ready to go out on a limb and commit myself to being a pro. I think that happened when I read some things in the back room of a pub, an open reading, needless to say, and discovered how heady a pleasure it can be to have an audience. One thing that had held me back, I must admit, was that I don't greatly enjoy the company of literary types. The more literary they are, the more miserable they seem as human beings. This isn't just a complaint, it's a lament in the elegiac manner. I've been fortunate in my friends, and since I earn my living bookishly, I have no illusions about authors. My best friend and severest critic, this is Harold Korn, with whom I've shared a house up here in Maine for several summers now, is a lawyer with an ear for music who takes pleasure in words as much as I do. A very old friend teaches English in Colorado, and we correspond. I couldn't have gone on writing without those two. But I've yearned secretly for a poet I could write to. Editors, it turns out, are too busy. Of course, with all those hordes of poets sending in manuscripts, more poets writing than there are readers, it would appear. Is it William Carlos Williams who's to blame for the current monotony of manner? Or is it something more pervasive, a general pulling inside oneself because the environment is so bad out there? The other day it occurred to me that a whole generation has been so deadened by rock music that an ear for the music of words must be obsolescent. You're in love with words, I was told, by a poet, yet, in a tone of accusation. What he meant, I guess, was that I tend to use too many of them. So you can see why your letter, with its sweet and generous compliments for what in some quarters is evidently seen as a defect, meant so much. The years from 1983 until 1994 were the decade of glory. And the interesting thing for someone who has assigned to him the task of editing the letters is that there are really very few letters from that decade. One, and none of them is of interest. And almost none of them is to a literary figure. Why should she write letters to poets? She was 60 years old. She was 70 years old. She had nothing to prove to anybody. She was not a part of a circle. She was too busy, on the one hand, enjoying her laurels, but not resting on them, accepting invitations to go and meet people and read, and to write these long poems about bus trips, a genre which, of course, she shares with Elizabeth Bishop, who wrote one great bus trip poem. Amy wrote several. And writing more poems. So the letters from the last decade are of no particular literary critical interest. They are mostly, when writing to other poets, of a business sort. Thank you for the invitation, or come to my workshop, or it was a pleasure to see you, it was a pleasure to meet you. She had nothing to gain from writing letters to famous people. She continued to write to her family, and she continued to write to her old friends, and those are the letters primarily that fill this book. In 1992, she won a MacArthur Award. And at that point, she bought the house in Lenox, Massachusetts, where I lived 2 years ago. At the same time, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, and she died. So she died at the age of 74 in the house in Lenox, from which I made my compilation here, overlooking the backyard in which her ashes are buried. She had, by some stretch of the imagination, a perfectly uninteresting and certainly unpublic life. But by another way of reckoning it, she had a remarkable life, if only because of the depth of the creativity and the powers of observation that she brought to that life. I've spoken for an hour, which is more than I should have spoken for, so I think I shall stop on that note and leave you to read on your own the last poem, which I would have discussed, called Nothing Stays Put, which begins with a nod to and an echo of Wordsworth and ends back on the Iowa farm from which she came. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture presented by the University Professors Program. Speaking was Professor Willard Spiegelman of the Department of English at Southern Methodist University. Professor Spiegelman's lecture was titled A Poet's Life in Letters, The Case of Amy Clampett. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skog, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.